every Sunday night at 8 p.m. Eastern in Studio B. www.freedomslips.com and revolution.radio. Check it out.
People's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We gotta stop them! They're gonna kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or human beings!
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to win the change to the people who run it, to the people who own it. That unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you've got it.
Right, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio.
Yeah. The key thing is, don't be inhaling, don't be ingesting.
Stay inside, don't drink or eat anything.
These are important questions.
I understand that. Highest moment the last 8 years.
Highest moment the last 8 years. Well, I think the most important, the most compelling was 9/11 itself.
Welcome. This is the special live edition of Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, doing the show every Friday evening here on Revolution.radio, the greatest of free speech radio networks. Please do support Revolution.radio by going to that URL, finding a way to support this wonderful operation. Completely uncensored speech. And you know, this is the one place I can talk like this because the tidal wave of censorship washing over the United States and the world has pretty much drowned an awful lot of formerly free outlets. It's been impossible to reach the kinds of audiences that we were reaching in the early days of the 9/11 truth movement and other truth movements. Tonight I'm going to be talking about censorship in the first hour with Fran Schur. She's a psychologist and she's well known from the Architects and Engineers documentary films. And then in the second hour, we're going to talk to some actual victims of censorship. Henry Herskovitz just got censured, although thankfully not yet fully censored or shut down by the Ann Arbor, Michigan City Council for his ongoing weekly protests outside the pro-Zionist Beth Israel Synagogue. Henry's Jewish ancestry hasn't saved him from being pilloried. And then Monica Schaefer will join us halfway through the second hour. She has also been massively censored. Her video on Sorry Mom, I Was Wrong About the Holocaust, where she plays her violin and apologizes to her mother, got taken down from pretty much every place. And her brother, well, actually, she served time in prison for her nonviolent political views. And her brother, Alfred, has been in prison since 2018 in Germany for the same crime of holding views that the authorities don't like. So censorship victims in the second hour. Let's get talking about censorship with psychologist Francis Schur, author of Why Do Good People Become Silent or Worse About 9/11? This is a psychological issue. What has happened to us, folks? What has happened to this country? And why are we putting up with it? Well, let's find out what Fran thinks. Welcome. Hey, Fran, how are you?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, you're sounding good.
Good. I thought you were going to call my cell phone, and I think David came in and answered my computer. I was
okay, great. Well, we had a special cameo appearance from David Chandler. Together. Cool.
I had to reinstall my Skype, so I was a little concerned. But I'm glad we're together here, Kevin. Hi.
Hi. You sound great as always. It's wonderful to have you back on the show. And your series on why do good people become silent or worse on 9/11 is becoming better and better as it gets longer and longer. And the world gets crazier and crazier. And so we need psychologists like you to explain what's happening. I'm puzzled. How have things developed over the past few years? And maybe how did you come to write these latest installments in your series?
Well, I'm just as flummoxed as you are about the whole thing. It's just, it seems like it does keep getting crazier and crazier. And the way I deal with it is I write, you know, and I try to write, and it's my outlet. It's my creativity. It's my outlet for trying to figure out what the heck is going on. Well, I guess, let me see. How did I get into this? You know, I was, of course, perplexed by why people can't see the evidence for 9/11, so that started the whole series with being published on Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And then the writing team there, I was actually going to write on a different subject about 9/11, which you will know something about. I was going to write about the random computer generators and precognitions about 9/11.
Cool. And, you know, that's kind of far out, but it's also extremely scientific.
It is actually extremely scientific, and the Architects and Engineers writing team didn't want me to go there because it's into parapsychology or psi. But it's very scientific, and it's the most interesting thing. I will hope to be eventually writing about that. But anyway, they wanted me to write on the media, because I agreed with them. The media is obviously the main reason good people become silent about 9/11 or worse. And so I was writing about the media. I was not an expert in the media. It took hours and hours of research, really trying to look into things, becoming as informed as I could be in order to write these. It turned out to be not one article, but four very long articles on the media. And the first one was what happened to, part 21, which is what happened to our investigative journalist. Why is it they don't work for our corporate media anymore? You know, they work for themselves. And kind of like you, Kevin.
And, yeah, I can't imagine trying to do what I do and get paid by a major outlet. I don't think that is possible.
Exactly. And then the next one was part 22 on the CIA and how did the CIA get embedded in the media? And how did that happen? What's the history of it? Does it still happen today? Then there's part 23, which was supposed to be on the structure of the media. How does the structure of the media cause censorship and propaganda? And this is about the structure of the media. About that, it became so long and so unwieldy that I realized it really needed to be two parts. And one, and it very nicely fell into the legacy media, which is, I call part 23A. And then, so I finished that maybe a couple of years ago. And then the next one was going to be on the digital media. What happened to our digital media? We had lots of free speech on the digital media on YouTube. And then suddenly social media, digital media started shutting down. So what happened there? So that's part 23B, which I just finished and just published recently, just in the last month or so.
It's a frightening story, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And so then as I was writing that part on the digital media, well, guess what happened? COVID. And that happened in early 2020. And And of course, it was just fit in perfectly with the censorship in the media, because the censorship in social media, digital media, as I call it, is warp speed censorship. It's like we had plenty of censorship before COVID, but when censorship playing on Trump's words, the operation warp speed for development of the vaccine. So as I
Fran, I'm sorry, you're cutting out a little bit. Is your okay. Is your internet connection okay?
If it's not, I'm going to have to move my computer to another room. So let me see. So I don't know what to do about it except maybe move my computer to another room.
Is that easy enough to do?
It's not too hard to do.
It might be probably worth doing because, we just had you interrupted at a couple of crucial points and missed a few words. Okay. And we don't want to miss your words.
Okay, great. I'm going to get David to help me really quickly here.
And, okay, great.
You can entertain the listeners until I get this done.
Okay, sounds good. Just interrupt me when you're back and ready to go.
I will.
Okay, great. So, yeah, this is pretty interesting timing. So Fran is working on what's happening to the digital media article sort of in late 2019, just in time for COVID to come along and push this digital media censorship thing into overdrive. You know, a lot of people are scratching their heads over this, that sort of just when the authorities were desperate for an excuse to ramp up the digital media censorship, that it already begun using Trump as the main excuse, right? We have homegrown American fascism coming at us, and if people are allowed to see the media that they want on the internet, they might actually vote for this guy, and it would be terrible. Well, yeah, I agree Trump is terrible, but there's something wrong with this argument that you have to censor the digital media to prevent Trump from becoming a dictator. Wait a minute, you're setting up an even worse dictatorship of the social media companies and the people pressuring them. So anyway, it was interesting that they made a little bit of progress there. But then when COVID came along, suddenly the people pushing back at official stories could be cast as public health threats. You know, no longer were we just political troublemakers and enjoying our free speech rights under the First Amendment, which we've been doing since 9/11 on that issue. But now if we talk about COVID any way but the approved way, then we're threats to public health. We're killing people. Oh, my God. So suddenly it's time to shut down all the alternative voices because of this public health emergency. And that's completely insane, obviously, but that's what's happened. And did all of the censorship actually help the public health situation? I don't think so. Quite the opposite. Now, nobody trusts the authorities. A whole lot of people really, really mistrust the authorities, maybe even more than they need to sometimes. And the more they censor us and the crazier the censorship gets, the more it looks like they have something to hide. Actually, maybe that has helped public health by convincing a lot of people not to go along with bad advice from the authorities. I don't know, but it's certainly contributing to a completely insane atmosphere in this country and the destruction of the First Amendment. And that's the core of our Constitution, the core of our whole society that is under attack. And it's not good. So that's my two cents worth. And the psychological perspective on this is, of course, looks at the weaponization of the politics of fear, fear-based brainwashing or trauma-based mind control. And Fran writes about this in this latest installment of her series. Sounds like she's getting to the new room. Fran, are you there in the new room yet? Maybe not quite. So her latest article, part 23B, The Role of the Media, The Structure of the Media, Digital Media, and Warp Speed Censorship in the COVID Era, does get into this transformation of the free internet media that we enjoyed for quite some time, or largely free anyway, to this bizarre situation we have today where people are just trying to find some place to post things on the internet, and then they get shut down and they try to go somewhere else and they get shut down. And, you know, anybody that actually allows free speech on their platform becomes a target. And it's just happened to Substack, which is where I publish. Substack is under heavy pressure right now to get rid of free speech. And once again, it's the public health threat of people who are supposedly spreading COVID misinformation. Only a lot of those people are actually putting out better information than the authorities are. And in fact, the authorities are admitting that they were right about many things. But that doesn't matter because we're not allowed to hear the other side. That seems to be the excuse for ramping up the censorship. Once that gets institutionalized and everybody just accepts that it's normal for the whole internet to be censored, you know, we're going to be living in a whole new world and it won't be good. So I think if there's one thing that we should all be able to agree on, it's that the internet is just a bigger and better telephone. Nobody should be allowed to spy on you. Eavesdropping should be a crime. Zuckerberg should be in prison. Everybody else making money off of spying on what people do on the internet needs to go to prison. It's like the telephone, so nobody can spy on anybody. Nobody should know who's calling who or what they're saying. And it's like the telephone, you can call anybody you want and say anything you want. And then if there's a crime that's committed, bring in the FBI and they can go to the court and ask for a warrant and so on and so forth. I mean, it's really simple, folks. The internet is just a telephone. All the protections that apply to the telephone pre-internet era need to apply to the internet too. And how complicated is that? Not very. But apparently the authorities don't want you to notice that. They want you to get used to institutionalized digital censorship, and we need to push back as hard as we can against it, which is, of course, what we're doing. Well, I hear some more background noises. Fran, are you in that room?
Go ahead.
Yeah?
Hello?
Hey, hi, David. How are you?
Okay.
That's David Chandler of Scientists for 9/11 Truth, hanging around with Fran Schur and helping her get her computer in order someplace where it will get better digital reception, giving me an excuse to be like Alex Jones and ramble on without allowing my guests to talk. But in this case, I'm not like Alex because my guests aren't trying to talk. They're trying to get the computer set up. So I have an excuse to ramble on and talk your brains out, which is really my thing. That's Alex's forte. So I'll let him do that because I think I hear Fran sounding like she's just about set up. Fran, are you there?
I'm just about here with you.
Just about here. All right.
Yes, yeah, I'm almost here. It's been
well, that might be even more here than I am, for all I know. I think I'm here. I'm back from vacation. I was off traveling down to the Southwest last week, which is why I didn't do False Flag Weekly News last week. But I am here now, here being home in the undisclosed location in the woods of Western Wisconsin. And I am fully present and ready to attend to the wise words of psychologist Francis Schur, looking at the way fear has been weaponized to terrorize the population into submission, to accept public myths like the myth of the evil, scary Muslim terrorist, which was the whole point of blowing up the Twin Towers on 9/11, and the myth of COVID, the sacred myth of this disease coming out of nowhere and creating a pandemic, and we all have to obey orders in order to save lives, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This fear-mongering and weaponization of public myths is something that you need to be a psychologist to figure out, and it's great we have Frances Schur on the case. She's one of the very few professional psychologists who is willing to go there and actually look at these issues, which are so toxic from a career perspective for so many people. And then that's part of the fear, too, I think. It's not just the fear of the hijackers, the fear of the virus, but it's also the fear of what happens to you if you get out of line and say the wrong things. Fortunately, Fran Schur is pretty fearless. And I guess in the second hour, pretty fearless, too, actually, going there in a place that's even scarier in some ways. So it's great that we can still do this here on Revolution.Radio. We're actually encouraged to do this at Revolution.Radio. They don't pay us a whole lot. In fact, they don't pay us anything. But they do provide a platform. And you know, I'll tell you, the last outfit on earth that's going to ever deplatform anybody for saying the wrong thing is Revolution Radio. Okay, Fran, are you set up?
We're set up, Kevin. Where were we? I think I was explaining how I started writing about this whole thing. And then when COVID hit, I was writing about the structure of the media. And then when as I was doing that, the structure of the digital media, and as I was doing that, COVID hit and we saw censorship just skyrocket. And I'm calling it the warp speed of censorship, playing on Trump's Operation Warp Speed. I think that's about where we ended, wasn't it?
Yeah, right, right. You know, and if I were a paranoid conspiracy theorist, I would be very suspicious about the way that sort of just at the time when they're really pushing to find an excuse for social media censorship and to crack down on the internet, suddenly along comes COVID and they can cast free speech on the internet as a public health threat. I mean, call me paranoid, but that timing really makes me suspicious.
I don't know. That's really interesting, Kevin.
Feel free to diagnose me if you want.
Yeah, really. Paranoid schizophrenic. or reality.
Hey, can I put that on my resume?
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, that's how this particular essay, it's called Part 23B, became so long. And that's the reason it has 12 sections to it, because when COVID hit, it's not writing just about 9/11 anymore. And I realized there were a lot of psychosocial comparisons between 9/11 and what was happening with COVID, with the official narrative, COVID and the censorship. And so this particular essay, I focus on those psychosocial comparisons. Kevin Barrett's done a great job looking at the comparisons. Other comparisons between the war on communism, war on terrorism, I think it is, and on the virus. So I stick to what I'm best at, which is observing people. And I really focused on two themes. One is fear. How did fear affect us all after 9/11? And how did fear affect us all after the advent of COVID? And then the other theme is on censorship. What happened? How did we get this warp speed of censorship when COVID hit? What happened? What caused that? And so that's how I wound up writing this long essay on this particular subject. And so anyway, I'll just pause there and see where.
So it is so compelling, you know, these comparisons between 9/11 and COVID in terms of the way they both triggered these outbreaks of kind of mass hysteria based on fear manipulated by the media. And again, you know, those of us who notice that and then start to scratch our heads about, you know, what could be the larger purposes involved. You know, it's easy for us to see the geopolitical purposes of 9/11. But with COVID, there's kind of a spectrum of analyses, and a lot of the dissidents seem to think that it's really intentional. That is, they're cracking down on freedom. They're trying to make the West a more kind of regimented society. And then there's also the geopolitical angle, but it's been downplayed. Like, everybody knows that 9/11 was about starting a war, and we know who the various beneficiaries were. It's all pretty obvious. But with COVID, people are making money off it, sure. But, you know, was this like a U.S. attack on China combined with a psychological attack on China? Certainly very suspicious the way it popped up in Wuhan with just the right time, and then jumped over to Qom, Iran, to hit the Iranian elites. So there are these kinds of parallels between the two. And I guess you didn't write too much about the geopolitical side. You're looking more at the mass psychology involved.
Right. I'm looking more at, at the individual psychology and the mass psychology,
right,
and how authorities use our fear to control us as well. I think it's really the section that I'm calling the psychology of fear. Is the section that I think I have the most unique contribution to make, because the real reason is because I've had so much fear in my life and I've had to do so much healing with it that I really feel I understand how deep our fear goes, and what we have to do to heal it, and what happens if we don't heal it, how vulnerable it makes us to authorities who want to control us. So then the next section right after that was on the politics of fear, and that's how people in power, how they have used our fear, weaponized it against us, to control whole populations, and how this played out throughout history in just a few examples that I gave. And then the one right after that is very connected. It's called Whistleblowers on the Politics of Fear. And in that, it's very important for people to read that. It's really a very small summary of the book, A State of Fear by Laura Dodsworth, in which she reveals the whistleblowers in the UK who were behavioral scientists who advised the UK government on how to make the population extremely afraid so that they would comply with lockdowns. And it's very important to read what these whistleblowers are now saying. They're basically, in a nutshell, what they're saying is, we really regret what we did. We did not realize how fearful people would become. We have to see that these are the tactics of a totalitarian state, not a democracy. And we really must decide what kind of society we want to live in. So they're very forthcoming, with their regret, their remorse about how they advised the government in the UK. It just so happens that these people, not this particular group, but a group connected with them that advised the UK government, not only advised the UK government, but they have branches all over the world, including the US. And we saw the fear mongering around the world being really very, it's like an echo chamber of fear mongering around the world. So on this whole COVID thing. So,
do you think part of the reason they regret it is not only that the fear got so out of control among a certain segment of the population, but also that the other segment of the population, one that maybe you and I belong to, saw that they were being manipulated, got angry, and what the result was a polarization between one group of people who are panicking and doing everything the authorities want and then some, and then another group of people who are very angry, can see they're being manipulated, suspect the worst, and many start imagining even, you know, worse than the reality probably is. And so you end up with this extreme polarization, and obviously that's not healthy for society. And I wondered if these people who had regretted their fear-mongering had also understood that has created polarization that can't possibly be good for public health.
Right. Well, they certainly must recognize that now. I don't know if that was a motivation for them coming forward and talking to Laura Dodsworth and being so forthright in what they were saying to her. I really can't know if that's their motivation or not. I got the feeling it was very sincere, that they saw the amount of fear that people had, and they were sincerely reconsidering what they had done. They were using psychology as a weapon, as a way to manipulate and control people, not as what psychology should be for, which is how to help people live a better life, how to heal, you know. So I don't know. I got the feeling they're very sincere in their motivation. But, you know, who knows? You'd have to talk to them individually to try to sort that out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. Do you know of anybody who was involved in the post 9/11 terror propaganda who has come forward like this and said they were sorry for it?
No, I don't know anyone.
And that's weird because they've, according to Gidge and Palya, they killed almost 30 million Muslims, almost all civilians in this series of wars. So, you know, that's a massive Holocaust, a lot bigger than the 6 million Holocaust. And, yet we haven't heard a single person who was part of this, effort to mobilize the West behind these genocidal wars to come forward and say they were sorry.
Kevin, what's the name of the author in the book that you're talking about?
Gidgen Palya is the author. He's an Australian scientist, and the book, I believe it's called the Post 9/11 Muslim Holocaust and Genocide, It was published, I think, last year.
Okay, thank
and,
you.
And, of course, you can debate his figures and methods, and everyone has. Of course, you're not allowed to debate the figures and methods of the 6 million Holocaust, but you're certainly allowed and indeed encouraged to debate the figures and methods of the 30 million Muslim Holocaust,
wow.
Which is a story in itself. But in any case, clearly there have been many, many, many millions of people killed, and not yes. both directly and indirectly by these wars. And one would think that the people involved in blowing up the Trade Center and doing other things to propagandize for those wars would start to feel bad about it. But so far, I haven't heard anybody come forward and say so.
Good point. You would think so, and I haven't heard of that either. It's a very good point.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I knew millions had been killed because of the 9/11 wars. I had no idea it was 30 million.
Yeah. So, well, actually, it's he to get that to that figure, he not only takes the number of people killed directly and indirectly.
Indirectly.
But yeah, both. And so he gets the indirect numbers in part by looking at population growth and what the population should have been if there uh-huh. hadn't been the war.
Right.
And then assumes that the deprivation both killed people and prevented people from being born. So that's how he gets that large number. So the actual number of people directly killed would be much lower, and even the number of people indirectly killed would be somewhat lower because that 30 million figure includes maybe a couple of million people who should have been born but weren't.
Right, I see. And then that's not even including people who were horribly maimed physically and psychologically.
Indeed. And made refugees chased out of their lands, their lives ruined. Yeah, that would be tens of millions more.
Millions made refugees, right. Yeah, so it's not even talking about that.
Right.
So yeah.
Yeah, no, somebody should come forward and say they're sorry for that.
Possible, but I have not heard of any.
Yeah, that's weird. You know, we know the whole German society, as we're going to talk about in the second hour with Monica Schaefer, has been totally beaten into submission in guilt for what they did during World War II. And I think a lot of people from a lot of countries should be very guilty about what they did for World War II. But it's interesting that one country has been singled out for that one war. And, you know, here's a series of wars based on this grotesque lie of 9/11 that killed a lot more people than any Holocaust from World War II. And nobody's talking about it. Nobody's sorry for it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm not sure about the figures, Kevin. I'm sure you would know this way better than I would, but I think there's about 60 million people killed by World War II total.
Right.
Isn't that right? Yeah.
That's about right. Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to just insert in here a little correction that I'm not a psychologist. In Colorado, you need to have a PhD or a PsyD to be a psychologist. I have an MA and I'm a retired licensed professional counselor. So what I call myself is a psychotherapist. So that's why I just want to correct that. So
okay, I'll try and correct that in my radio listing to not get you in trouble with the Colorado authorities.
Yeah, or just I'd rather correct it rather than someone else correct it. So.
Right, yeah, they'll probably do a fact check on me, of course.
Exactly.
Yeah, you talk about the fact checkers, too. I mean, this is pretty funny. It's the idea of having good fact checks is not such a terrible idea that, you know, if you had really good researchers who could, yes. you know, come to a balanced sort of assessment of factual claims, that would be a great resource. But unfortunately, the so-called fact checkers out there are really not that, are they?
No, they're really not that. It's, it's Cheryl Atkinson who really clued me in on how that got started. And she's a very good investigative journalist. And when I write these essays, I'm writing because I'm learning, you know, and I'm just sharing what I'm learning. She really made it very clear, and so do many other people, that they're really part of the propaganda arm of the media, and they're really not real fact checkers. I still use them, like if there's an urban legend type thing that's going around, you know, I might check Snopes for that. I think they're valuable for that. But they're very good at spin. And, you have to be pretty good at spotting spin when you read them. They're pretty good at it. So, anyway, yeah, they're not real fact checkers. You're right.
Right. Yeah, I actually still do use the fact checkers. I just want to see what the other side of the argument is.
Yes.
And that using that method, you actually can assess a whole lot of things even without a lot of technical expertise. You know, one side is saying one thing and the other side is rebutting it by saying something else. And then you can check and find out whether the rebuttal is remotely adequate. And if quite often what I discover is, well, if this is the best they can come up with as the rebuttal, that controversial statement actually stands pretty tall. It's it hasn't been knocked down yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good to listen to your detractors because they have information that they say things you need to know. And so you can research and be better and more accurate in whatever you're saying.
Isn't it interesting how the COVID fact checkers quite often seem to sort of change the subject? Like I've seen this with, you know, the science journalism of, say, Alex Berenson, who's, you know, providing this controversial COVID information. And then if you go to the fact checkers who are attacking him, rather than actually sort of assessing his facts and trying to, you know, put them in context in a reasonable way, what they'll do is they'll just say, well, this thing he said contradicts the CDC, so it must be wrong. Or this thing he said, let's say Berenson is talking about the statistics from countries that have a national health service that actually are collecting their data really carefully and comprehensively, like Israel, the UK, Germany, Denmark. And he's saying that, look, these are reliable statistics. And what they're telling us isn't quite what the American lousy statistics that aren't properly collected are telling us. So the truth is probably more what's coming out of these other countries. And then the fact checker rebuttal is something like, well, what Berenson said was contradicted by the CDC or by this like American study. So it totally avoiding the actual point, which is Berenson right in saying that these other countries have better data? They never even address that. And this is just one example of the way that so many of these fact checks are actually, they convince me that the misinformation purveyors that they're attacking are probably right.
Oh, interesting. Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's something, you know, it's going to take someone who's pretty astute to sometimes see the spin that they're doing. And one of the things, that I think you're talking about is they kind of put out a straw man or they switch the subject, you know, So it takes someone who can read very carefully and do a lot of research to see what how they're spinning it sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Although you don't have to be all that astute after a while. You see patterns emerging. And so once you've noticed this a couple of times, then it gets easier. You start noticing that they just keep doing the same thing over and over.
Yeah.
So the fear is at the basis of this. You mentioned that, you know, you had to heal from sort of fear-based trauma yourself, and that makes you able to empathize with and understand the fear-based traumas of things like 9/11 and COVID. And, you know, I know that you memorably quoted someone who said, you know, I wouldn't believe what you're saying about 9/11, even if it were true.
Right.
It seems like people are kind of like that about COVID, too. It's like they just don't want to hear it. What's with that?
It's true. I'm looking and looking at this and observing and trying to figure it out myself. And I would say a little pattern I'm seeing among my friends is that one of the patterns is that the more fearful they have been of Trump, that fear is still very salient with them. The more fearful they were of Trump, I have an image, is that the more fearful they were of Trump, the more quickly that they jumped into the arms of whatever Biden says it's the way to go. You know, it's like jumping from the frying pan into the fire out of fear, or it's like jumping into a silo and you won't stick your head out to look at any other information other than what authorities are telling you. So if the Biden administration is telling you, you take this vaccine and you will not get COVID, which Biden did say that you take the vaccine, you won't get COVID. Well, the pharmaceutical companies didn't even say that. they said that it would prevent more serious disease. But Biden said, no, you'll not get COVID. They'll just, you know, these people who are so fearful of Trump are just going to believe everything that the Biden administration says. I'm seeing a pattern there. So I think it's very fascinating to see this level of fear that came up when Trump was president, and then how that fear was then stoked to a huge degree by the appearance of the virus. And then they were given a solution, which is do what we say, lock down, wear your mask, wait for the vaccine, you know. So that's one pattern I'm seeing so far, which I think is really interesting.
Isn't that interesting that it's operating mainly on the sort of other side of the political spectrum from the one that 9/11 operated on? 9/11 convinced the right wing to start waving flags and calling for a genocide of Muslims, and the left wing was much more suspicious. And, you know, when we used to show 9/11 truth films in places like Minneapolis, we would get 1,000+ people. They'd all be Democrats. And, you know, the polls showed that a majority of the people of Minnesota blamed Republicans for Wellstone's death in a plane crash. Senator Wellstone, of course, was murdered by Dick Cheney because he was looking into 9/11 and trying to stop the Patriot Act and so on and so forth, stop the Iraq War. And so at that time, the left wing was open to seeing the reality, and the right wing wasn't. And then it seems like somehow that flipped with Trump, and now the fear-mongering is primarily targeting the so-called left. And, of course, I'm using these terms advisedly, that they're not, you know, the left isn't really very far left in terms of the global political spectrum. But, you know, what passes for a left in the United States,
right,
which has been captured by the big corporations now, apparently, it's interesting that they're the ones now who are marching in lockstep. And then the people doubting the official propaganda are more likely to be on the right. Do you have any ideas about why that is?
Perplexed. In fact, I land on the way progressive side of the spectrum. And yet all of my friends who are also where I am on that political spectrum, who also see through the COVID narrative, see through the scaremongering, see through the lies, we're all completely perplexed when we see people we've been very close to, highly moral, highly intelligent, highly progressive people, just in lockstep with this narrative. And they will not look. They are not interested in looking. They will not look at evidence that contradicts the worldview, contradicts what the Biden administration is saying and Fauci is saying. We're perplexed. We talk about it. I talk about it a lot with some of my friends. We notice things like it's the Republicans in our Colorado legislature that are trying to get bills passed to prevent vaccine mandates in Colorado or vaccine passports. It's not the Democrats. It's the Republicans who are saying it's my body and I have a right to choose. No. So I hold a sign at our rallies saying my body, my choice, which is a message to everyone. It's a message to the progressives that they need to be consistent on their message. It's a message to the right, you know, that we need freedom in all areas, you know. There was actually a funny scene at a rally I went to where a more right-wing person was holding a sign saying, it's my body, it's my choice. And a progressive, actually doctor, MD, a friend of mine, went up to her and said, oh, that's the sign we used to hold for pro-choice, you know. And she immediately looked shocked. She dropped the sign, and my friend picked it up and held it.
Oh, no.
It's like, it wasn't good enough.
It's like, a cartoon.
It's a cartoon. It's good enough for a movie, you know, for a sitcom. But it perplexes us. The people, the Republicans in our legislature are doing their darndest to get people the freedom of choice here. And it's the, we have a, we have our legislature and our governor, all Democrats. So Senate, the House, and the governor. So they've not been successful. And the Democrats are just in lockstep, you know, and with following orders from whomever they're following orders from.
And you know, I sort of have assumed, and maybe I'm wrong, but, you know, I've, like you, I've sort of leaned a little bit to the left, or sort of left anarchist or libertarian throughout most of my life. Yeah. And I always assumed that the people on the left were more cerebral, more critical minded, that the right was the place of the gut feeling, you know, the visceral kind of patriotism and attachment to values like family and country and God and things like that. And there's, you know, something to be said for that, but they're not generally critical thinkers who are kind of attacking the dominant paradigm, whereas the left is. That's what the left is supposed to be doing, is saying all of these myths that we live by are fallible and we can do better. We can figure out a better way by using our intellects and sort of attacking and deconstructing the official way of doing things and these kinds of gut feelings that you conservatives are so attached to. So that's the paradigm. I always thought, yeah, it worked for 9/11, where, you know, the right was just emoting and waving the flag. And then some on the left were willing to actually think, wait a minute, who benefits from this? Why did those buildings blow up and things like that? But now with COVID, it's suddenly the opposite. And it did occur to me that if you were a psyoper who wanted the country under control, so let's say you knew you were going to have to go to war to keep your empire in charge of the planet, and you would worry more about the left than the right. Because the minute the shooting starts, the right is just going to start drooling like a bunch of Pavlov's dogs and go off to kill, kill, kill. The left is in danger. There was a threat to start staging anti-war demonstrations. And so you would be more worried about the left. And so you would need to find some scheme for turning the left into a bunch of knee-jerk, orders-following, you know, non-critical thinking idiots. And, hey, COVID seems to have done that. So maybe they're doing this to get ready for the big war. What do you think?
That's really an astute observation, really, looking at, in general terms, the personalities of the left and the right. And I'm sure many people might like to correct us on that, but that's very interesting.
I'm sure a lot of people won't agree. And I'm not even sure I agree with myself on this, because, you know, if you go back to World War II, it was the right that was skeptical, and rightly so, as it were, about that war, about Pearl Harbor, which was a false flag, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not really just the left that's smart enough to see through things. It's the right can, too.
Yes.
And I have friends who insist that it's the right that's actually much sharper, and the left is a bunch of idiots who just believe in their myths. They have a point sometimes, more and more so as time goes on. So who knows? But
yeah, I think we do need to start talking to each other and breach this divide. And I'm seeing COVID as possibly, for some of us, it's going to breach that divide. I know those of us who are identify on the left, we're seeing this as an opportunity to breach the divide and talk to our more conservative brothers and sisters, you know. And we have something in common here, and we're grateful, you know, we're grateful to those Canadian truckers. You know, we're very inspired by them. We're grateful for what they're trying to do, the laws they're trying to pass. And we're grateful for people like Ron Johnson, who's holding these Senate hearings. And we're grateful to Ron DeSantis for holding the line in Florida. You know, it's just fascinating to me. We're cheering them on.
Yeah.
We're cheering them on because we understand from our research, we understand, you know, things that our progressive and liberal cohorts do not seem to want to look at. They're in their silos, and they won't stick their head above the silo to look at something else. This reminds me of something that Cynthia McKinney said to me. Was a few years ago. We were having dinner together here in Denver, and Cynthia said, she said, you know, we all have to get out of our silos. She said, when I was first running for Congress, I had to get in my car and drive out to Ku Klux Klan territory in Georgia. Can you imagine how terrifying that was for me to do that? She's an Afro-American, for those who don't know Cynthia McKinney.
Yeah, she's going to be on the False Flag Weekly News tomorrow, actually.
Oh, so, great.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, that she's, yes, and good. So anyway, she said, can you imagine how terrified that was for me? Says, but I did it. I went and knocked on doors, and I won the election, you know. So she crossed the boundary. She reached out and breached the divide. She lifted up out of her own silo and talked to people and got them to look out from their silos. And as her point is, her message is, we have to get out of our silos and reach out to other people. And I think one of the things that we need to do on this whole COVID issue is we need to, because there's so much fear. The fear, I've just never seen fear like this in our society. We have to talk to people about their fears. And I haven't done that yet, but that's my plan, is when I get a chance to talk to people who are believe very differently than I do, is really get it down to what are your concerns? You know, what are your fears? What are your concerns? And try to breach the divide in that way, because they're not listening to facts. So anyway, just thought I'd mention that little story about Cynthia. And
yeah, I think that's a great story, and it does illustrate how we're right now is a great time for folks to reach out and talk to the kinds of people that they maybe, you know, wouldn't have been talking to before.
Exactly.
Certainly here, I didn't ever thought I'd be cheering for Ron Johnson. You know, I actually kind of liked Russ Feingold, the guy that Johnson beat. Feingold was a close friend of Paul Wellstone, and I think Russ knew that Paul Wellstone's plane was shot down or zapped down or whatever by Dick Cheney and his friends, and that 9/11 was a false flag. I personally handed Russ Feingold several of David Ray Griffin's books, and he looked like he kind of got it. And Russ was the only senator to stand up against the Patriot Act and vote against it.
Oh, wow.
So I kind of liked him. And then Ron Johnson came along and beat him, and for all I could tell, Ron looked like just a neocon. But now, hey, he's probably doing a better job on COVID than Russ Feingold would have. So go figure.
Yeah, go figure. It's just fascinating. I really want to understand this more, and I don't understand it. One of the things I am shocked by, and I'm assuming that this poll I'm going to tell you about is accurate. It's the Rasmussen poll. Have you seen that poll, that recent poll from January?
I'm not sure. What does it say?
Basically, I think it was sponsored by the Heartland organization or group, which is, of course, going to be more right-wing. But assuming the poll is correct, they say that 59% of Democrats support government forcing Americans to remain confined in their homes if they refuse the COVID vaccine. 59%.
Oh, no.
Yeah, 78% of Democrats support Biden's vaccine mandate for businesses with more than 100 employees. It goes on and on. It's just absolutely shocking. More than one quarter of Democrats say parents should lose custody of their children if they refuse the COVID vaccine. How did Democrats, you know, how did Democrats become so authoritarian, so really crossing into being tyrannical, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost so it's really pretty absurd. I mean, there's something grotesquely humorous about it. I had on a guest a while back who a comedian named Mona Sheikh, who basically it was so hostile and it just, you know, spent the whole hour screaming at me. If I asked her at one point, so you want to send us anti-vaxxers to the gas chambers? She basically said, oh, we don't need to because, you know, COVID's going to do the job.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, it's that hostility, that anger, that hostility. And I think it's on both sides. But I think I've seen it a lot on the side of the people who think everybody must get vaccinated and then we will feel safe. Of course, it's completely absurd, you know. But anyway.
Yeah, it does reflect, I think, maybe a kind of a public myth about science and the power of scientific medicine to supposedly solve problems, and the larger sort of myth of progress that scientific technical progress would solve all human problems. And, you know, I thought that myth died a long time ago. You know, World War One helped to kill it, and then the postmodern movement helped to kill it. It was all built on, you know, Lyotard and the postmodernists all said, look, nobody believes in this idiotic myth of progress through science and technology anymore. Look what science and technology have done to us. But I guess it hasn't quite died yet, has it?
Look what has done to us? I didn't.
Science and technology.
Oh, right. Exactly. Yeah. One thing I think that what I want to do is focus back on the whole fear theme, and one of the things I just before I published this,
and we only have about a minute and a half left. Sorry.
Okay. So. I learned about Matthias Desnet and his theory of a mass formation. And I think everyone needs to, if they don't know, they need to look at that. I think it's a very compelling theory. One of the tenets, he said there's four conditions that need to exist in a country before people form this mass formation. It's basically about the formation of a crowd who all believe very intensely in a narrative. And they scapegoat another people, which is what's happening right now. It's what's happened throughout history. But I think where it's very compelling, but I think where my section on fear, the psychology of fear, dovetails with that and explaining why there's this free-floating anxiety that he says is one of the conditions in society. Where does that free-floating anxiety come from? And I think I do address that. So I think the two theories they really dovetail together. I look more at the individual. He looks more at the sociological. So I know we're probably out of time, but
yeah, we're pretty much at the end. But it is interesting, isn't it, that you know you wrote about the internet censorship and Google went and tweaked their algorithm so that if people looked for mass formation psychosis, instead of seeing Desmet's article, they would get a bunch of debunkings.
Oh, very interesting. Of course. Yeah.
Yeah, which is actually kind of a symptom of the very psychosis that he was writing about.
Yeah, exactly. Although I prefer not to call it psychosis. I don't know that he does. Other people call it mass formation psychosis. I think it is delusional, but I try to stay away from as much pathologizing as I can. It is a phenomenon, though. We do see it.
I don't know. I mean, if it's something as a lay person that looks completely crazy to me, I don't mind a little pathologizing. But what do I know? You're the professional. I'm just a radio host, and that's why I invite you on to have this kind of conversation. Well, thank you so much, Fran Schur. Your series, Why Do Good People Become Silent or Worse About 9/11, is absolutely brilliant. It's the best stuff on the topic, and someday it's got to come out as a book. And part 23B, the new part on the role of media and the digital media warp speed censorship in the COVID era, is also indispensable. So keep up the great work, and God bless.
Thank you, Kevin. You
take care, Fran.
Your good work too. Thank you so much.
Bye. That's Francis Schur. Kevin Barrett back with Kevin Bruce Fitz and Monica Schaefer in the next hour.
We'll be right back after this message.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Interested in the paranormal? Murder mystery? Real natural law? Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crypt Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crypt Rick. crypt. Yes, I will. Thank you. Welcome to the crypt.
Join me at Revolution Radio, Studio B, at 11 a.m. on Saturday for Free Association, when we take a look at philosophy, spirituality, psychology, social issues, and geopolitics. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Studio B at freedomslips.com.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of whose program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps. All right, thanks for listening while we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Welcome back. This is the live version of Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, broadcasting live from an undisclosed location here in the woods of Western Wisconsin every Friday evening right here on revolution.radio. It's archived at No Lies Radio at the UNZ Review. That's UNZ.com. And you can find out more about this show by going to the radio link at truthjihad.com. And you can get early access to the shows by clicking on the subscribe at Substack link at truthjihad.com. Well, this is a truth jihad, folks, and only an all-out crazed truth jihadi would bring on guests like I'm bringing on this hour. These are guests who are being condemned by the ADL, the JDL, pretty much all the DLs, and even the Ann Arbor City Council. Well, they didn't condemn Monica Schaefer, who's coming on in a half an hour to join the conversation, but they did condemn Henry Herskovitz. Henry has been leading a protest at the Beth Israel Synagogue in Ann Arbor, Michigan, for something like 18 years. And now, after 18 years, the city council, which has heard a whole lot of complaints from the usual suspects about this, finally did pass a resolution condemning Henry and his group as, get this, anti-Semitic. Who would have thunk that they would ever use that expression? Anyway, we're going to get Henry's side of the story, which apparently is maybe not acceptable in the mainstream media because they never will let you hear that side of the story. That's why we're here at Truth Jihad Radio. So, hey, welcome, Henry Herskovitz. How are you?
Hey, Kevin, how are you doing? I'm doing fine here in Michigan.
All right. Yeah, I'm doing well, too. So, you know, congratulations on once again making the news. And, I mean, I am shocked that they called you anti-Semitic.
Well, not only did they call me anti-Semitic, and they do that because one of the signs that we have every Saturday morning is Jewish power corrupts. And earlier in the month, I spoke to the city council about this Jewish power, and I defended our sign. I said that there was a great deal of, you know, we try to get our message out. And, you know, for instance, an ad in the local newspaper and a Jewish, powerful Jew steps up and writes a letter to the editor. And now our ads are the ads that we were going to pay money for are no longer accepted because of this little Jewish power. And I explained to council, OK, so that's small potatoes. But what do you think of this Jewish power? And that occurred in the attack of the USS Liberty that you're familiar with in 1967. The President Johnson, under this, you know, not wanting to offend his friends in Israel, his Jewish friends in Israel, issued stand down orders from the Sixth Fleet that were trying to come in and rescue the USS Liberty from the attack by military members of the Jewish state. And so, in my view, he committed treason. By not allowing fellow airmen to and Navy people to come to the aid of this ship that was being attacked in an attack that lasted longer than Pearl Harbor.
You know, it said, Henry, that Johnson was at the time of the Liberty attack, he was in bed with his powerful Jewish girlfriend, who was, I think, the wife of the ambassador or something like that, the Israeli ambassador. So I guess that's a kind of Jewish power, too.
Well, that is maybe Epstein can if you were with us could explain that even further to you. But when I got word that the city was going to pass a resolution, and this is not the first time the city council has passed the resolution against us, I guess it is the first time they used the word anti-Semitism against us. And of course, that's all the rage now. Even the term anti-Semitism is being respelled. The New York Times, you might be familiar with, has a style code, and they're now dropping the hyphen and the capital S of anti-Semitism, and now it's just one word, all lowercase letters. And surprisingly, or not surprisingly enough, an article in the local Jewish news this month revealed that style change came at the request of the powerful Jew Deborah Lipstadt. And again, I told City Council that this is Jewish power on full display to anybody that wants to look. I mean, it's just right there. I said language is yet another victim to Jewish power, but it's not the first time. You know that the word Holocaust didn't enter the lexicon until 1982. This juggling around of language, this way we describe things. And I was, you know, it was just amazing. I said, while they're condemning us, and following the edicts, the commands of Jewish power, I said that city council passes a resolution again, The powerful Jews speak up. They demand of city council that they do something. They say jump, and the city council says how high on the way up. And they pass this resolution unanimously. Even the Palestinian member of the city council, my ward representative, and he voted in favor. And I guess I understand that because of this hidden hand, of this he knows that he's going to spend the rest of his political career defending his vote against. How could you possibly stand up against this Jewish power, knowing that you voted against the resolution condemning condemning anti-Semitism. So,
you know, so wait a minute. Was this a unanimous vote?
It was a unanimous vote, yes.
Wow. Well, that certainly proves there's no such thing as any Jewish power whatsoever in Ann Arbor, doesn't it?
that's absolutely right. You're making me laugh here. You know, I told them, you know, I said, if council really wishes to combat anti-Semitism, tell the Jews to start behaving themselves. I said that anti-Semitism always.
Well, wait a minute, Henry. Isn't that kind of unfair, like, to lump all the Jews? I mean, you have, you know, your problem in Ann Arbor isn't with every Jew in Ann Arbor. It's with a certain select group, isn't it?
I think it's with all Jews. I think this is a good distinction that we should unpack here and talk about. Because I think if you go up to any Jew that you know and hold a button in front of them and say, if you push this button, Israel goes away. Will you push the button? I'll bet you will find zero.
Really?
I'd be willing to push the button. Yeah. I mean, the rabbi explained to us here in Ann Arbor that every member of the Beth Israel congregation supports Israel's right to exist as Israel.
Wait a minute. So Henry, this button that you push and Israel goes away, it's not a nuclear button. It's like a peaceful button. I hope.
Yes, it's a piece. I mean, that's. I mean, I'm not a violent man. I'm 150 pound heart patient. You know, so I'm not a threat physically.
I mean, that makes it more understandable why you wish they would push it.
Push the button and it goes away. So there's no Jewish supremacism in Palestine, and everybody lives as Palestinians wanted to live 80 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds reasonable to me, and it is kind of shocking that you think the percentages would be that high. I don't know. I remember reading Robert Scheer's book. I forget what it was, a long time ago. And he wrote about how Israel had become sort of the only thing that really brought American Jews together that they were all concerned about. But I think even in his book, he admitted there's really only like maybe 2/3 to 3/4. And then there is this, you know, this group of American Jews that really doesn't give a rat's patootie about Israel. And they might be as many as like between 1/4 and 1/3.
Well, I'll challenge you on that. I'll say you go out and find me one. It'll push that button. And then we'll get to be able to talk about a solution to this Jewish problem. And it is, it's a Jewish state created in an area that the people didn't want them there. They threw out 750,000 Palestinians so that they could develop a Jewish majority. If you read the nation state law that Israel passed in 2018, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, it's an incredibly racist document, and if people don't believe it, just suggest that they exchange the word Jewish for white, and see how it reads. Like America is the homeland of the white people, you know, all the, you know, which is a lie, and the same thing is with Israel. The Jews,
isn't that funny? This, the same group of people is so unwilling, really, to question Israel as a Jewish state, but they're completely. Really upset about the rise of this white nationalist movement that wants America to be a sort of a white state or a white Christian state or what have you.
Yeah, isn't that clever? They want to focus on white supremacism. They never even mention the word Jewish supremacism. You could go to these faux peace groups like Jewish Voice for Peace and scan their website for the phrase Jewish supremacism. You won't find it. If you scan for white supremacism, you'll find it a dozen, two dozen times.
Well, you know, and that makes me wonder, Henry, that, you know, whether maybe that I'm not trying to agree with the city council or anything, but the expression, you know, Jewish power corrupts, you know, targeting the notion of Jewish power is, you know, it has a kind of a weakness, which is that if you're totally against all forms of Jewish power, well, what does that mean? You want all Jews to be totally powerless? No, that can't be right. So maybe a better thing to target would be Jewish supremacism, because it is in Israel. That's the problem. It's Jewish supremacism. And I don't think anybody could really defend Jewish supremacism. And it does have a parallel with the white supremacism that we're all being trained to hate on cue like Pavlov's dog and, you know, drool in hatred when we hear about white supremacists. Well, so supremacists, the word supremacist has negative connotations, and it perfectly describes the phenomenon at hand, whereas I'm not sure that Jewish power does. Yeah, it's true that Jews, by and large, are on average, somewhat more wealthy and powerful than most other ethnic groups. Okay, but really kind of so what? If you say, well, there's this phenomenon of Jewish supremacism where they've got their Jewish state and their Holocaust, they're ethnically cleansing the non-Jews over in occupied Palestine. This is a symptom of a kind of problem in the Jewish community, a kind of sort of, you know, hyper in-group feeling and ethnocentrism in the Jewish community. Yeah, then you have a pretty good case. So maybe those signs should be targeting this Jewish supremacy or supremacism rather than Jewish power.
Well, come on back to Ann Arbor, and you can hold up a sign that says,
I mean, "Hey, it's a free country."
I will defend the sign because I think it's a Jewish supremacism that dominates our Congress and our foreign policy. I think it's Jewish power that does that. And in fact, in a book by the same name, Jewish Power by J.J. Goldberg, he spells out how powerful Jews are in the media and in the government. He had lunch with a guy that said, "See this napkin? By 3 o'clock, I could get the signatures of 70 senators on this napkin." You know, because they dominate our foreign policy. It's always Israel first. There is there's absolutely no differentiation in AIPAC meetings. There's no differentiation in Congress. When a leader of a foreign country can come in and get 28 standing ovations, as Benjamin Netanyahu did a couple years back, what office holder in the United States could even come close to getting 28? They couldn't get 15 standing ovations, you know. And it's Jewish power. Just there. It's the power when we put up a billboard. You know, we pay a billboard company $3,000 for a 3-month contract, and it gets taken down in a week. And we ask them why they took it down, and they say, "Well, the JCRC, the Jewish Community Relations Council of Detroit, started screaming at us." And you know, they didn't specify, but I know in my gut that there was threats of removal of advertising. And this method of dynamic silencing is written by Jewish authors as well as non-Jewish authors. It's a power that even prevents people from discussing Jewish power. That's exactly the essence of the phrase. So it's I stand by that. I certainly think it evinces itself or exhibits itself in the Jewish supremacist state of Israel. As you point out, that's what it is. But I do think that, as long as Jews are going to be treating Palestinians horrifically and holding the cudgel of the Holocaust above anybody's head who dares criticize Israeli behavior and talks about, Jewish identity politics or religious ideology within the Jewish religion, that tells people to dominate and go in and invade and expel the Amaleks and stuff like that. It is it's not a religion that really is universal in any way, shape, or form. It's very tribal. It's very insular, and which is the reason that we stage our protests at a conservative synagogue, because the racism that drives the state of Israel is born and nurtured within the walls of that synagogue. And it's where children, innocent children, are being taken to a foreign country to pose with soldiers and say, "The world is against you, and so you have to be strong and you have to fight back." And it's this us versus them paradigm. You don't see synagogues with signs like "Everybody is welcome." That's what I see on Presbyterian churches and Methodist churches and the mosque in Ann Arbor says, "Come in and explore Islam. And we will tell you about it, and you can become Muslim if you like." But if Jews are still going to define themselves through bloodline, It's a tribal faith. It's not much of a faith at all, as a matter of fact.
Well, you can convert to Judaism. I know somebody, I think my son's kindergarten teacher converted to Judaism. So it does happen.
Well, I believe, I could be wrong, but I'll bet you that there's not a single Orthodox rabbi in Israel that would bless that conversion. They would all say.
Right.
100%,
right. Yeah.
That is not
different schools
a valid
there,
conversion.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, when you have people like the Rabbi Menachem Schneerson, who said that the differentiation between Jews and Gentiles is like the difference between Gentiles and animals and cows. And that's, you know, we have to differentiate. It's on completely different levels that Jews are in God's image. And Gentiles are in an animal's image. It's I'm roughly translating this, but it's horrific. It's an incredibly racist statement. Alison Weir has a great article about this on her website, If Americans Knew, and listeners should go there and you know, search for the word Schneerson and they'll find this article. It's a you know, so my point to city council is, if you're serious about fighting anti-Semitism, you got to get Jewish behavior under control. And as Helen Thomas said, tell the Jews to get the hell out of Palestine. I echo that. You know, they stole the land. Ben Gurion admitted as much. And if I said to city council, quote, if Jews want the world to stop hating them, tell them to give it back. That would be a good start. It might even be long-lasting towards ending anti-Semitism. But the more Jews misbehave, anti-Semitism, no matter how you want to spell it, is going to increase. And I think it's interesting that they changed the word. They took the word Semite, capital S Semite, out of the word. Because that means,
well, they're hiding it because look who the real Semites are, right?
Exactly. They don't want to be associated with those dirty Arabs, right? Arabs. They don't want to be associated with Palestinians or anybody else who came from that area, because they know they didn't come from that area. You know, DNA tests if DNA testing proved that European Jews originated in the Levant, we'd hear about it as many times as we hear about the Holocaust. And I guess I was.
I've actually seen contradictory reports on that. I think I've seen reports claiming that there's a certain amount of DNA from the Levant in the Ashkenazi Jewish population that it would have come from the male line, and it looks like some males from the Levant procreated with European or Eastern European women, and that. That may have been sort of the beginning of the Ashkenazi population, which of course did sort of continue to interbreed with Europeans. So it is mostly European, but there seems to be a little bit of Levantine blood too.
I'm not, our friendship isn't going to be harmed by me disagreeing with you.
more research is necessary. I'm not sure whether what I just said.
I'm just stepping back like a lawyer does and say, well, if this is true, what would happen? And I contend that if it was true that it could be absolutely proved that Jews came from Palestine, we would hear it every day, 10 times a day. And we hear about the Holocaust every day, 10 times a day. And I'm remiss in not wishing you a happy Holocaust Memorial Day from yesterday.
Oh, is this the Holocaust Memorial Day today?
Oh, yesterday was. And,
yesterday, okay.
So, please accept my belated well wishes.
Interesting. You know, it's funny. I think I published I published my Holocaust parody article in terribly poor taste, I'm sure some would say. Certainly the city council would say that. I guess that was the day before yesterday. So it was on the eve of the Holocaust Remembrance Day that I did that. And, you know, may Yahweh forgive me. No, I was just kidding. Seriously, folks, Henry, the city council and others who don't like your protest probably think, well, this, you know, protesting a house of worship, that's, you know, that's kind of pushing it. But, you know, if you think about it, if there was a Christian church that supported the Ku Klux Klan and sent their kids to go, you know, get trained and brainwashed by the Ku Klux Klan, you might have folks out protesting that church. And so if you have a synagogue that's doing the same thing with Israel, which is actually a lot more racist than the Ku Klux Klan, a lot more vicious and has killed a hell of a lot more people and committed genocide, frankly, if you can protest the church, you should also be able to protest the synagogue.
Well, I may steal that analogy from you. I'll pay you royalties, though.
Kick in the royalties there at the trademark office.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about the court case that is ongoing. Do I have time to do that?
I think so. Yeah. Monica Schaefer should be joining us in about 6 minutes. But you can still talk even when she's on the show.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, I would certainly want you to wish her a fine and fair hello from me, because I'm a big fan of hers.
Fan of yours too.
And I know her brother is incarcerated for his political views in Germany, I believe.
It's crazy. He's been locked up since 2018.
Yeah, and that's just ridiculous. And people that feign support of free speech would do well by signing documents demanding the release. I'm blanking on his name. Is it Alfred?
Alfred Schaefer.
Alfred, yeah. Well,
he's been on the show a couple of times too.
Yeah, there is a there's a phrase called pilpul, P-I-L-P-U-L. I don't know if people know that word. But it comes from rabbis arguing the hair splitting, the fine differences in halakhic rule and stuff like that. It's actually a torturing of the words and phrases of any circumstance until you get what you want at the end. And with our lawsuit, it's doing exactly that. I don't know if your listeners know that 2 years ago we were sued by two members of the congregation and a very combative, aggressive Jewish lawyer named Mark Susselman in federal court. And their claims were that we were preventing them from exercising their First Amendment right to freedom of worship. And of course, that doesn't hold any water at all, because the First Amendment guarantee of freedom of religion only applies to the government, saying that you can't pray in one religion or uphold one religion over another. It has nothing to do with private actors, even if we were preventing them from praying at the synagogue.
So, which we're not.
And so the pill pull comes in, where they had to also sue the city government of Ann Arbor. The mayor is included in it. He's also a defendant, like myself, and the city attorney and the assistant city attorney are all thrown in there, because that's the government action, because they're arguing this in this pill pull, this hair splitting way. They're saying, well, you know, it's the government that's attacking these Jews and keeping these Jewish people from worshiping the way they want. So it is a violation of the First Amendment. And of course, the district court saw right through that and said, "Bull Twinkie, that's not gonna hold water," and voted in our favor. They dismissed the case. And this is going on for 2 years. The plaintiffs went to the appellate court, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, out of Cincinnati, and they got defeated there too. And after that, they went back to the same Court of Appeals. Because they had the case heard by three judges. They wanted the entire bench, the 16 or 20 members of the Sixth Circuit Court, to hear the argument. And they, as the Sixth Circuit denied that request, they said, we couldn't even find one judge that wanted to bring this up for a rehearing. So now they are, they're off to the Supreme Court. We most likely will be going to the Supreme Court now, and they're going after this. Another example of this pill pull is that the plaintiffs are saying, okay, well, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals said it's you know, Israel-American relations are of public interest, so you can discuss this with your First Amendment guarantees on the sidewalk. But our signs, since we say Jewish power corrupts, well, those are anti-Semitic signs. And the First Amendment isn't there to prevent that. And, you know, so that means it is an illegitimate use of the First Amendment. But they're twisting things around because we say that the corruptive influence of Jewish power, and you're right, it's not all Jewish power isn't bad. It only rears its head and becomes a problem when it works against the country's interests, when it works against freedom of expression. And so that is the, you know, we say that's absolutely a matter of public concern. But they're going to try to pill-pull the hell out of this thing and twist the logic and twist the words into trying to get things their way. They got a powerful lawyer named Nathan Lewin out of Washington, D.C., who's now appealing to his buddy Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court to intervene. There's been a split in the plaintiffs, and the other set of plaintiffs, the woman who is represented by Mark Sussman, has already made a writ of certiorari at the Supreme Court level, and it's I just read part of his thing today because it just came out yesterday, and it's just hilarious. I mean, he's talking about, you know, that we use the word kike. We don't use the word kike. You know, it's just amazing how things, you know, you point out errors to people. The man who Andrew Lappin, the guy that wrote the Jewish Telegraphic Agency article, I finally got a hold of him. To his credit, he had a good exchange with me, but his article said that we chant at the vigils. We've never chanted at the vigils. And so, you know, he finally relented and made a change to the article. But what he said was, this story has been updated to reflect that the protest group has not been recorded chanting any slogans during their Saturday morning synagogue protests. I mean, to me, that just screams pill pull. They're like, you know, it's like me saying, well, you know, we've never, you know, recorded Andrew Lappin having, you know, sex with a goat. So I guess we're just going to have to, you know, assume the best and move on or something like that. It's
he's never been recorded with that goat.
Right. I've never seen a recording of that. So, you know, but I'm not going to say he doesn't do it. See, that's the whole implication. But I will go on record as saying Andrew Lappin doesn't have any sexual relations with animals.
As far as you know, as far as it's been recorded. Okay, well, I'm glad we've got that straight at least. And I hope this this court case works out. I mean, it's of course generating all kinds of publicity. Unfortunately, it's only Truth Jihad Radio and others of like mind who are letting you tell your side of the story. The rest of it is all pretty much scripted by the usual suspects.
Bless you for that, my friend.
Well, hey, it's great having you on. And now we're being joined by Monica Schaefer. She's in an undisclosed location in Western Canada. And she has herself had a brush with the draconian censorship over in Germany. And her brother Alfred is still in prison since 2018, for free speech offenses. And Monica is one of the bravest people I know. She did host my 9/11 truth talks up in Alberta, and around the time that I was there doing that, she was studying the Holocaust issue, and she came to some very politically incorrect conclusions and spoke out and has never stopped speaking out. She made that video, "Sorry Mom, I Was Wrong About the Holocaust," which went viral and drew all kinds of panicky attention from the forces that don't want such things discussed. And so she's been kind of a free speech freedom fighter ever since. So hey, welcome back, Monica. How are you?
Hello, Kevin, and hello, Henry. This is just such an honor. How's my sound? You can hear me all right?
Sound great.
Hi, Monica.
Yeah, hi, Henry. I've been listening for the last half hour and have really enjoyed this interview, and just want to thank you again, Henry, for writing letters to me in jail. And I think that my lawyer actually talked about your, you know, interventions on behalf of myself, and I think also on behalf of others, and that you are Jewish. And so he particularly made a point of that to the judge in the court case and also in the bail hearings. Now, it probably didn't make a big difference, but anyway, it was talked about.
Well, Henry, like Gilad Atzmon, you're probably ambivalent or worse about your Jewish identity at this point, aren't you?
I'd say worse, but you know, if I can help Monica, you know, I'll be a Muslim if I have to do that.
Okay, put on that yarmulke for that purpose.
Yeah, maybe you're one of the people who would call yourselves an ex-Jew or a former Jew, because you know the work you're doing is just terrific, Henry, and I just want to thank you for that.
Well, thank you. You know, ex-Jew probably works. You know, I look at it, the whole insular attitude is something that I don't want any part of. Color me Gilad Atzmon. Or Paul Eisen, who actually was a friend of mine as well, is a friend of mine, and he converted to Catholicism. So.
Yeah, you know, my brother Alfred, he talks about this faulty operating system that the Jews operate on. It's just a really bad operating system. And so you've unplugged yourself from that, I guess, as it were. You know, you've completely extricated yourself from that. And so that's great.
Yeah, it's, you know, I mean, I still like a good Mel Brooks movie, but, you know, it's I'm just not going to. But, you know, cut my
I prefer the Marx Brothers, actually, myself.
Pardon?
I prefer the Marx Brothers.
Yeah, okay. Point taken. Go ahead, Monica. I didn't want to step on it.
No, that's all right. So, Kevin, you would like me to talk about Alfred, I would imagine. That's always
I mean, it's you know, time has gone by, and now I just can't believe this much time has gone by. He's still locked up.
There's something really important that I need to tell you right off the bat. The reason he is currently still in jail, because it's now been more than 3.5 years, and you know his original sentence was 38 months. That would have been over in September 2021. Why is he still in jail? I'll tell you why he is still in jail, and this is just so important that people understand this. He is in jail still because of the things he said in court during our trial in 2018. So there were quite a few times when the judge said he interrupted Alfred, because Alfred did his own defense. I mean, he had a lawyer beside him, but he basically spoke for himself on his own behalf. He did his own defense. Quite a few times the judge interrupted him and say, I have to warn you that if you carry on with what you are talking about now, then very likely we will have to do new charges against you. This is now breaking the law. Now,
defend yourself and we'll charge you again for defending yourself.
Oh, that's correct. Now, where else should you defend yourself but in the court? I mean, what happened to this notion of, you know, the judge hears one side and hears the other side and weighs it out and looks at the evidence of both sides and determines, okay, you know, makes a judgment. What's that all about? No, in Germany, you are not allowed to explain, for example, how you reached your conclusions that there were no homicidal gas chambers at the work camps, the concentration camps, and any number of other things about the so-called Holocaust. Okay, so you are not allowed to bring evidence. Okay, but Alfred, what he did, you know, he's a very courageous man. He let the judge say those things, and then he proceeded. He said, well, you want to lock me up for 6 million years anyway, and I am just speaking the truth, and I shall carry on. And, you know, something that I already discovered well before the trial started, because I was in jail for 6 months before the trial began, and so there were some bail hearings. And the judge, the justification document for keeping me in jail rather than letting me go and await trial at my brother's dwelling, like not to return to Canada. I wasn't going to try to escape. Like there would have been conditions. They could have held my passport. I could have had to, you know, report to the police every day or every week or whatever. Anyway, these bail hearings always ended in failure. I stayed in jail. And the document which gave the justification for that, I honestly wondered if I had been at the same hearing as the judge, because they fabricated things. And so I thought, well, this frees me up. You know, they make a decision beforehand and then they have their process. And the same thing goes for the trial. The verdict is predetermined and then they do their show trial. And, you know, on day one, Alfred did call it a Muppet show, and he also refused to stand up when the judge came in. The judge didn't like that at all, but he didn't want to recognize the authority of the judge over this it was an inquisition, essentially.
Well, it reminds me a little bit of a story by that great Jewish writer, Franz Kafka.
Yeah.
you know, the trial.
It is rather. Yeah. Okay, yeah, I think I have read it, but you'll have to remind me how that went. But even just, you know, the word Kafkaesque, yes, I've read enough Kafka to understand that it just makes you scratch your head in bewilderment and bafflement, because it's just so bizarre and nothing makes sense.
Yeah, you're being charged with something, but you don't really know what, and you're not sure, you know, when they're going to come and get you and precisely what you're supposed to do. And the whole, they're just making it all up as they go along, and it's one bureaucratic crazy thing after another. I mean, it seems like, you know, and then there's, of course, the trial in Alice in Wonderland, which I guess could be another model for the sort of prosecution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, when you say that they make it up as they go along, or you don't really know what you're allowed to say or not say, that actually is literally true, that you don't know what you are allowed to say or not to say according to the law. Because this law, paragraph 130, under which we were charged, and it's known as the Holocaust Denial Law, but the word Holocaust does not appear in that law. It is quite vague, really, but it does say that you are not allowed to diminish the crimes of the National Socialist government, and you're also not allowed to aggrandize their achievements or, you know, say good things about them. So that's basically in a nutshell. And then there's some things about, you know, incitement and something about the genocide law that gets invoked in that. But they don't mention any specifics. They don't tell you what you're allowed to say. For example, they don't tell you that if you were to say 5 million Jews died or were killed, which of course is a lie, but let me just give that as an example. Is that Holocaust denial? Does it? They don't specify the place where a crime took place. They don't specify the weapon that was used to carry out the crime. They don't specify, you know, gas chambers, or was it electric conveyor belts, or was it diesel van? I mean, all these things have been written about, you know, the different methods that were used and the numbers of Jews who allegedly were murdered, even in the mainstream media. And I would say the Jewish owned mainstream media, the numbers vary wildly. And all these things, we brought this into the trial, you know. And so why is it that none of those numbers or facts get taken to task? But
right. How can you know what you can say when, you know, the father of academic Holocaust studies, Hilberg, said 5.1 million Jews dying in the Holocaust was his best estimate. And yet others say that if you don't say exactly 6 million, then you're a Holocaust denier and should go to prison. How can anybody know what they're allowed to say in Germany?
Yeah, that's exactly, my lawyer made those arguments, and he made them very well. And I'll tell you something, it was the first day or the second day of the trial, he made this very rousing speech, about an hour long, and it basically to say why this case should be stayed, why it should be thrown out, why it should be dismissed, and why the law itself is completely unconstitutional or unlawful, whatever. The whole thing is illegitimate. And he made this absolutely fantastic speech. And at the end of it, the prosecutor has a chance to speak. And, you know, all she could come up with was that he looked too often in the direction of the public gallery when he was speaking. He's supposed to address the judge. And he used too much passion in his voice. I'm telling you, this is
maybe they're going to have to arrest the lawyer. I understand they do that sometimes. They actually arrest lawyers for defending people who have these opinions.
Oh, yes. You know, it's a very, very fine dance. It's a very fine, you know, they're going on a tightrope, the lawyers in Germany who do this job of defending people who have come up against this law, paragraph 130. It's such a fine dance. And I can tell you, the lawyer that I had, Wolfram Nahat, he's the same lawyer who defended Ursula Haverbeck and also Sylvia Stolz. Now, I suppose you could say, gee, he doesn't have a good track record because they both went to jail and the others also went to jail that he defended. But, I mean, he's in Germany, don't forget, and like these Kafkaesque laws, that's what we're dealing with. But I'm telling you, he does this fantastic job of walking that tightrope. And really powerful, the things he says. It's not for lack of his intelligence and his arguments that the people have gone to jail. No, but he himself so far has stayed out of jail. The same cannot be said of other lawyers. You know, of course, about Sylvia Stolz, who went to jail for doing her job too well for Ernst Sandl. And then she went to jail again for the speech that she gave after she got out, and the speech was not in Germany. It was given in Switzerland at an anti-censorship coalition. I mean, the whole thing, I could go on and on about how bizarre it is, how fiercely the Jews protect their story.
Could I call it
Holocaust humanity.
And ask,
yes, please,
Kevin,
do.
Isn't that an example of Jewish power? I mean, isn't it right there writ large, where you can and cannot say things in a court of law and say, I can't bring evidence. You know, I can say with complete certainty, 6 million Jews did not die in World War II. And that's going to end me up in prison in Germany or Israel. You know, I didn't read Kafka, but I know the word Kafkaesque too. And it's just, you know, this is use that pill pull ability to distort and twist and torture the language until they get what they want. And like Monica is expressing here, you know, glancing sideways at the jury as opposed to speaking to the judge. It's just, it's pathetic how they can dominate these things. You know, my favorite journalist was Helen Thomas saying, get the hell out of Palestine. And they destroyed her after that. And they also destroy journalism. Everybody's afraid to ask. There are no journalists anymore.
That's right.
Pretty soon there won't be any lawyers anymore. I mean, how can you study law for you know, how many years they do study law? It's an immense job to understand that and then just be throttled at the end and not even allowed to say that's Jewish power that's working that. So that's, I guess, the difference between an activist and a politician or a lawyer, is we get to say what we want. So, continue, Monica. I don't mean
No, that's fantastic. Cause I did listen to your half hour before I came on and the, you know, the main theme of that was Jewish power. Yeah. Jewish power is, the power to forbid you from talking about Jewish power.
Exactly. Yeah, Gilad Asman has said that a number of times, and I think he's onto something. Certainly these kinds of laws, these exceptional laws around this particular Holocaust story are examples of a certain kind of power of a certain ethnic group that's really gone on steroids. Like I can talk about Gijan Polya's work on the 30 million Muslim 9/11 Holocaust, And if somebody comes along and says, I think 30 million was too many, you know, it's only, you know, 20 million or even 10, or some would even say even as low as 6. somehow I don't think there's any country on earth, including the Muslim countries, where they're ever going to arrest you and imprison you for Muslim Holocaust denial. But and the same would be true for the Irish Holocaust, when the British, of course, with Jewish bankers having a lot of power in that government, genocided Ireland in the 19th century, and in fact, more than once in the other centuries as well. And we'd go on and on and on about all of these Holocausts and genocides that Gideon Collier has studied.
Yeah, you can deny, you know, any one of those, like you say, Kevin, and you're not going to be charged or go to jail. But, you know, the interesting thing about it is those ones happened, like the Holodomor. It actually happened. So the one that didn't happen, that's the one that you go to jail for questioning their story. And that's exactly the point. I mean, they have to use the force of law and the force of putting somebody behind bars to keep their story going. That's exactly the point. And then if they forbid you to defend yourself in court or bring evidence, that's how they keep the story going. I mean, it's pure force. It's pure force. That's the only way to keep it. Truth does not fear investigation. And so they obviously fear investigation. I think they're in panic mode right now. I mean, they're just going crazy with, you know, more and more laws about you have to, you know, more states are bringing in the compulsory Holocaust education. And, you know, I mean, they're very afraid of losing their narrative here. And, you know, I think that the Holocaust is really the key. So when it's like the linchpin lie, when this one falls, then the whole Jewish question is exposed. Is the light of day comes onto the whole entire Jewish question, because the narrative is always that, oh, the Jews have always been persecuted. Poor Jews, poor Jews. While they are doing this to their host population, their victims, you see. So it's all inverted. It's all backwards. And the Holocaust is the linchpin of that narrative. It's their story. It's their identity. You ask any Jewish person what's their identity all about and whatnot, and the Holocaust will definitely come up. So when we take down this, and I say when, it's not if, this is falling apart, this story. More and more people are looking into this and, you know, saying, gee, I don't think this really happened. Well, then their whole structure falls down, really. Their whole narrative, their house of cards just comes tumbling down. And it just, you know, it can't come too soon, really, because they're the ones who are behind our current terrible, you know, the attempt to genocide of us with this, the jab, the COVID thing. Like, it's the same people, you know, and what I can't.
That brings up what Fran Schur said in the first hour about this kind of trauma-based mind control and the politics of fear. You could argue that Jewish people themselves are the primary victims of the psychological conditioning that makes them so terrorized by the Holocaust story that then this whole ethnic group sort of as a whole, you know, led by the most powerful factions within it, ends up behaving in these destructive ways because of the suffering of these people who are brought up. You know, if you saw that film Defamation, the documentary showing these little Jewish kids from Israel being taken to Poland to go look at Auschwitz. And they're being told the whole time that all these Polish people want to kill you. They all wanted that. See that there's a scene where this little kid is in a park, like, and the handlers point to the old Polish man on the park bench and say, see, he wants to exterminate you. So these poor Jewish people are traumatized from birth to believe that the world wants to exterminate them just because they're Jewish. And I think that probably has a lot to do with the various kinds of irrationalities and pernicious behaviors coming out of the bad parts of that community.
Well,
I think,
you know,
the Holocaust
is
a linchpin. I'm sorry. I think the Holocaust as a linchpin is really a terrific analogy there, or a descriptor. You know, Monica, I came at this from the Free Palestine movement. And, you know, when I realized that it was the Jewish state that was oppressing Palestinians, but we couldn't mention Jews doing the oppressing, you know, we had to say the state of Israel, and it was all very, very controlled. And but when you realize that that the Holocaust is there in the Palestine movement, because no matter how bad things are for Palestinians, the world is convinced that it was always worse for the Jews because of the Holocaust, you know? And if you ask somebody, why were Jews victimized in Germany prior to World War II, well, then you're a true anti-Semite, right? Because you can't bring up the fact that the Judea declared war on Germany in 1933. You know, you can't tell people that 94% of Polish Jews didn't even speak Polish. You know, they spoke Yiddish. You know, how's that for turning your back on the host country in where you live? What about the getting the United States into World War I against Germany? How did that make regular Germans feel? Isn't that logical? Can't we just talk about this stuff? So Lynchpin, you know, I hope you're right. I hope that it's falling apart as they keep plugging away. You know, I have a Google alert on the word Holocaust, and I'll get 10 to 12 stories per day, even when it's not National Holocaust Remembrance Week or whatever it is.
I'm glad you talked about the Palestinians. Like, they must all the time say, look, why are we being punished for the alleged, I'll put in that word, alleged crimes of the Germans, but even if the Germans had have done all these evil things, why are the Palestinians being punished, you see? So, but the Jews, they use this Holocaust thing as a forever, they can do anything. And I mean, there's that perfect clip that on Shulamit, what's her name, that former Israeli cabinet minister.
Shulamit Aloni?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And she's answering questions to,
the Jewish Amy Goodman.
Yeah, exactly, the Jewish
Amy Goodman. Dominating Democracy Now, right?
What, yeah. Amy isn't Jewish enough for you, Henry?
controlled opposition, but nevertheless, that was just a dynamite piece there, that minute and a half where, you know, she asked her, well, whenever we criticize it, or somebody here criticizes something that the Israelis are doing, you know, they're called anti-Semitic. She says, oh yes, it's a trick we use. In America, you know, if somebody criticizes us, we call them anti-Semitic. And in Europe, we bring out the Holocaust. Yes, it's a trick. And then she says, oh, you know, it's okay. We're smart and it's okay. She was basically justifying all that.
That's chutzpah, isn't it?
Oh, unbelievable. But anyway, I know we're getting close to the top of the hour.
Yeah, we have 30 seconds left here.
Oh, my. Well, you know, Alfred's birthday is in 2 days, and if you want to write him a letter, please do.
Happy birthday, Alfred.
Yeah, go to my website. It's called freespeechmonica.com, Monica with a K, and there you will find some information about, you know, where to find the address for Alfred, support Alfred Schaefer, and then also recent letters from him and things like that, because I would have loved to talk more about how he's doing. He's actually, in spite of the circumstances, he's been in solitary confinement for over a year now, since December 3rd, 2020. Solitary confinement. And it's because of his defiance against the masks. Like, he insists on breathing freely, and he is steadfast in that. But I'm telling you, they try to break him, but he is not being broken. His spirit is alive and well. He just radiates this winning attitude. It's fantastic. You know, if people would think, oh, gee, he's naive. No, are you kidding me? He's at the front of this war.
And he will write back to you if you write to him. He writes quite an eloquent letter. People can find the address at Free Speech Monica. That's Monica with a K. FreeSpeechMonica.com. Well, thank you so much, Monica Schaefer and Henry Dershowitz. It's been a great discussion. We get to hear the other side of the story.
Thank you.
Kevin Derrick is signing off.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio.
Join me and the Brian Ruse Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens and their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is
the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization. Number three, the truth about Adolf Hitler, how he was the opposite of what we've been told. Number four is advanced ancient global civilizations. Join me on the Brian Roux Show, Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 on Studio B on Revolution Radio.
Hi, I'm Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal. Consider yourself served. You are to appear Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, Studio A. My forte? Foreclosure and contract law. Grab your legal pad and pen. Learn a broad spectrum of law spanning administrative, criminal, family, tort, and federal law. Fools and losers cling to old cases. I dissect and comment on the latest rulings that control the courts. Don't be a loser. And if you don't appear, you will be held in contempt.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m.